You never really need a news hook to examine the United States and gun violence. Mass shootings, if we work off the common definition of four or more dead or injured in a single incident, occur in America on more days than not, with such frequency, indeed, that it usually requires a double-figure casualty count to even make the news. Statistically, there are about 300 Americans alive right now who will be deliberately or accidentally shot dead within the next week. Another 400 or so will use a gun to take their own lives. But US President Joe Biden believes something can be done about this. Earlier this month, he announced several executive orders on gun control, hoping to spend some of the political capital available to a newly elected president, and perhaps to exploit the current travails of ferocious gun lobby group, the National Rifle Association. What kind of gun control legislation could actually be passed and enforced? How can you persuade people who aren't already persuaded by an annual gun death toll running into the tens of thousands? This is the Foreign Desk.
I'd love to turn on the television and watch the Super Bowl and see a 30-second ad from the NRA that says, you know, if you're a gun owner, you need to do the right thing. You need to lock it up. You need to store the ammunition one place, the gun itself someplace else. That simple step would have a significant effect on gun suicides.
Thanks to you, the members and supporters of NRA, no national gun law has passed this year.
The ideology of gun rights, the religion of gun rights, is stronger now than it's ever been, and that is what's going to survive, even if the NRA, which helped create it, may not live to or may not endure to be able to see it through.
To me, it's connected with so many other issues in American life. It's connected with economic opportunity. It's connected with racial justice. It's connected with a civil society in which everyone can walk down the street and go to the movie theater and go to work without the fear of being shot. That's an America I believe in.
Hello and welcome to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests today are Chris Brown and Robert Spitzer. Chris Brown is president of the gun control lobby group Brady. She joins us from Arlington, Virginia. Robert Spitzer is distinguished service professor of political science at the State University of New York and the author of several books on gun control. An eighth edition of his book, The Politics of Gun Control, was published last year. He joins us from Cortland, New York. Chris, I'll ask you first the big question, and then we will look at a series of smaller questions. When you think of the problem of America and guns, how actually solvable is it? Because by most best guesses, there's about 400 million guns at large in the United States. You're not going to get all of them. So with the best will in the world and with all the political capital you might want, what kind of impact could realistically be made?
Nearly 100%, actually. And what it takes is really the political will to pass some pretty basic laws that 90% plus of Americans agree with, literally, from the last polls, to expand the Brady background check system, to continue the momentum that we have in the states around certain issues, but also recognizing that we have an epidemic in the United States, right? It's 25 times more likely to get shot in the United States than any other industrialized country in this earth. And we have to understand, if we're going to fix it, the different components of what leads to 40,000 people a year being shot and killed, and nearly 80,000 additional individuals being shot and surviving those injuries. Part of that is homicide. Part of that is unintentional injury of kids in their home with guns. A very small fraction are our definition of mass shooting, and two-thirds are suicide. And with the suicide piece, it's really important to understand the people who experience gun suicide are gun owners by and large. And so if we're going to solve this problem, there's a big piece for policy. There's a big piece for enforcement, and there's a big piece about public education, about the need to safely store guns in the home. And if you have an at-risk person in your home, to reconsider buying a gun or having it in the first place. So it's comprehensive, and we can do it. and have it be entirely consistent with the Second Amendment. The larger issue is how we have reasonable conversations around that, and that's what we're working towards.
Robert, what's your assessment of how much change would need to be driven by law, and how much change needs to occur in the wider culture and in people's behaviour? I guess there's an argument that changes in law could help to drive a change in the culture, but where does the change really need to come from? Does it need to come from the top or from the bottom?
Well, optimally, you'd like to see change in both areas, but that's a bit pie in the sky. And we know that changes in public policy can then result in behavioral changes. I'll give you a quick example. In the 1980s, wearing seatbelts became required in basically every state. When those first laws were enacted in the 1980s, the seatbelt compliance rate was very low. Maybe 20, 25, 30% of drivers wore seatbelts. After the law was these laws were enacted, that rate steadily increased. And today, virtually everybody wears a seatbelt in a car. And it happened because of law changes, but also a public campaign that accompanied it. And one of the things I have argued for a long time is that a group like the NRA, the National Rifle Association, the nation's oldest and largest gun group, doesn't have to give up anything except money if they launched a concerted advertising campaign telling gun owners to store their guns responsibly. I'd love to turn on the television and watch the Super Bowl and see a 30-second ad from the NRA that says, you know, if you're a gun owner, you need to do the right thing. You need to lock it up. You need to store the ammunition one place, the gun itself someplace else. That simple step would have a significant effect on gun suicides, just as Chris Brown was talking about, on accidental discharges, on gun thefts. It would have an array of benefits, and none of that would involve direct government action. There is no single one magic solution, partly because you'll still have crime and you'll still have society dysfunction, even if you had no guns. But we know from all sorts of research that we can reduce the total amount of harm if we can have better control of guns, if we can zero in on those guns that are more likely to be used in criminal activity or be used illegally or in bad situations. There's plenty that can be done, but the national government right now, aside from President Biden, is kind of at a standstill on this issue, it seems.
Chris, when you think back over your own work on this and the bills that you've worked on and advocated for and managed to get passed, does it strike you that there have been moments of progress which are examples that could be built on further, the kind of laws that gun owners and even the politicians which purport to represent them would actually sign off on?
Yes, and I'll give you a recent example of that. But I do want to say, obviously, I lead the Brady organization. Brady was founded by Jim and Sarah Brady. Jim was President Ronald Reagan's press secretary, shot in the line of duty, a gun owner, a Republican. And to pass the Brady Law, which just keep in mind, the Gun Control Act of 1968 required background checks, but there was no mechanism in that law to ensure it happened seamlessly. So within seconds, right? All Jim and Sarah Brady did, and it was substantial, was mechanize the 1968 Gun Control Act. A big thing that has come forward across the states in the wake of Parkland, and it's a relatively new law, is something called extreme risk protection laws or red flag laws. Those are laws that allow law enforcement, or in some cases, in some states, family members, to seek a temporary court order to remove guns from individuals who are deemed by a court to be at risk to themselves or others. Every single one of those bills has now passed and come into law in 19 states in the District of Columbia. And most of that has happened just in the last few years because Americans are fed up with this.
Robert, there's a question following up from that, which I wanted to put to you. That, I mean, as Chris points out, and I'm sure quite rightly, Americans are sick of this, and the polls do continually show support for stricter gun control. But certainly when America's gun crisis is observed from outside, and I've seen it happen a lot, that there is an obvious crisis point. There's a Columbine, a Sandy Hook, a Las Vegas, a Parkland, any number of others, including the actual or attempted assassinations of presidents, such as the one in which Jim Brady was injured. I think the rest of the world kind of thinks, okay, now something has to change. Now they will get it. And people think of the way that the conversation around guns changed in Australia after the Port Arthur massacre in 1996, or in the UK after Dunblane the same year. And yet that doesn't quite seem to happen in the United States. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's true that Americans have to some degree become inured or immunized regarding these terrible shootings when they occur. But in political terms, that suggests the dynamic behind that, which is this, that in the gun community, for them, this is their top number one issue. This is what they care about. This is what will cause them to get up off their sofas, to make a phone call, send an email, contribute money, vote based on the gun issue, go to a demonstration, and do other things politically to voice their point of view about the gun issue. Most Americans favor stronger gun laws, but for them, it's not a number one issue until something comes along like a Sandy Hook. And then the public is galvanized and office holders may respond. And indeed, we've come close in the last 20 years or so to action, but not quite across the threshold, at least at the federal level. I should say at the state level, a great deal has been going on. But what happens at the national level is that a group like the NRA will essentially hunker down during the crisis moment, and you won't see them issuing statements with rare exceptions or saying anything publicly because they want to wait for the political storm to pass. Because usually in a few weeks, the public's attention turns back to other things. And so you return to sort of politics as usual. And the NRA and gun rights groups do their best when nobody's really paying much attention. But there's one other factor at play, which is that in the last decade or so, gun safety forces like the Brady Campaign and some new organizations that have been created during that period of time have started to make slow but steady victories where people, candidates for office running on a gun safety agenda, did very well. Joe Biden was elected president in 2020 with a very strong gun safety platform. So that's not going to flip everything at the national level overnight. But the gun issue is one of the issues that is standing right there at the U.S. Senate right now. And if they, you know, can break the impasse in the Senate, then there could indeed be action.
Robert Spitzer and Chris Brown, thank you both very much for the moment. We will have more from you later in the show. Much of the argument over guns in the United States centers around the Second Amendment of the US Constitution, the one which affirms a citizen's right to bear arms. No organization has done more to uphold a fundamentalist interpretation of the Second Amendment than the National Rifle Association. Here's Frank Smith, author of The NRA, The Unauthorized History, on the NRA's evolution from gentlemanly rifle fraternity to feral gun cult.
Your Second Amendment rights are under siege, but they will never, ever be under siege.
The modern leaders of today's NRA falsely claim that the NRA was founded in support of the Second Amendment. And this is not true at all. The NRA was set up by two former Union Army officers, one of whom had also served as a journalist and was a publisher on military affairs, and the other was a rifle trainer. They established the NRA in New York City for the purpose of improving riflery, improving marksmanship among able-bodied men and active duty soldiers, first in the National Guard and then in the services, in order to better prepare U.S. troops in anticipation of future wars, most likely involving European powers. This was the eve of the Gilded Age. It was 6 years after the Civil War when the NRA was founded, and they were aware that the United States was coming into its own on the world stage and would most likely be involved or drawn into wars involving Europe very soon. And they wanted to make sure that American men, that American riflemen, had the skills and training they needed to be able to perform well in any future conflicts.
Thanks to you, the members and supporters of NRA, no national gun law has passed this year. It is not likely at this time that one will pass. If we will stand together, strong.
Until the NRA had no position on gun control for its first 50 years, it started raising the concerns about gun owners in the 1922 was the first editorial by the NRA that really flagged that. And then from the 1930s through the 1940s, the NRA supported gun control, never unconditionally. It was a qualified support. But the NRA, through these generations, provided a balancing test to balance the interest of gun owners versus the interest of public safety. And in 1977, the NRA underwent what is called the Cincinnati Revolt, which the modern leaders entirely deny ever occurred. Yet the father of that revolt is the only leader whose figure, whose image is on display in the National Firearms Museum inside NRA headquarters. His name is Harlan B. Carter.
Any national gun law, no matter how innocent in appearance, no matter how simple it might be, presupposes a still further growth in a centralized, computerized gun control bureaucracy in Washington, D.C.
And so he is still revered, demonstrating that the modern NRA, including Wayne LaPierre, who joined the NRA 1 year after the Cincinnati Revolt, all stem from this radical uprising within the group that changed it forever from the nation's largest gun club into the nation's largest and most powerful gun lobby.
Here's a message to every rapist, domestic abuser, violent criminal thug, and every other monster who preys upon women. Maybe you've heard the stories about millions of...
The NRA has done a masterful job on its own terms of expanding its reach, and it did that by playing upon people's fears, by promoting the notion, would you rather be raped or would you rather have a gun to defend yourself?
I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
But this strategy of fear-mongering helped gain the NRA support throughout the country. And also, they managed to cultivate grassroots support across the nation among gun owners and others sympathetic to gun owners, which became their base, which is real, right? The strength of the NRA is in its purse to some degree, but its ideology by this point is much more important, because they worked every different legislator throughout most of the 50 states, as well as in Washington, to bring legislators as well as elected judges over to their perspective. In addition to hiring people to write law review articles and put out other pro-gun information, including op-eds in major newspapers, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, all written by scholars who were receiving NRA funding, which they rarely, if ever, disclosed, as a way of communicating their message. And the NRA has done a tremendous job of organizing the largest single issue movement in the nation for gun rights. And the gun reform movement really is late to the game and is really playing catch up now, which is why you're seeing all these measures for gun control in Congress just hitting a brick wall in the Senate, and Biden all but abandoning any attempt to pass gun control under his watch, at least not now, while he's focused on things involving executive orders, which at the end of the day are temporary measures that won't make a major difference in the long run. I think the NRA is destined to go through a second metamorphosis now, and I think it's going to come out a much weaker organization. But gun reformers shouldn't take too much solace in that, because the groups that are going to arise and become stronger are other gun rights groups, such as Gun Owners of America, which has long been more radical and more openly has had ties in the past with white supremacist and white power organizations. So I think the ideology of gun rights, the religion of gun rights, is stronger now than it's ever been. And that is what's going to survive, even if the NRA, which helped create it, may not live to or may not endure to be able to see it through.
So as we set out this year to defeat the divisive forces that would take freedom away, I want to say those fighting words for everyone within the sound of my voice to hear and to heed, and especially for you, Mr. Gore. From my cold, dead hands.
That was Frank Smith, author of The NRA, The Unauthorized History. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. Still with me are Chris Brown and Robert Spitzer. Chris, Robert was talking in just at the end of the first part of the show there about the fact that President Joe Biden did manage to get elected president, talking about gun control and wanting to do something about it at last. What do you make of the proposals he's already announced?
They're an important step forward, absolutely. And Joe Biden ran on not being afraid to take on the NRA and understanding the issue. In fact, he helped pass the Brady Law with Jim and Sarah and the assault weapons ban. What he put forward were six executive actions a couple of weeks ago, and he appointed for the first time in many years a new ATF director who I know very well and is just an incredible guy. Why is that important? Because Joe Biden is recognizing that where we have really fallen down is not just in enacting law, it's also enforcement. So the collective actions that come out of these six executive orders really ensure that guns that are sold as kits in this country, so-called ghost guns, get regulated as firearms. Right now, you can buy them with no background check at all. And that the ATF is the agency in the federal government that is responsible for regulating gun dealers. Basically, that agency has been subject to a stranglehold that these actions release and open. Now, what I would say about it, though, is this is an important first step. What we want to see even more from President Biden is using the bully pulpit to say what I just said to the US Senate, which is either pass the background check with 60 votes, which is what you need to overcome the filibuster, or I will end the filibuster. He also needs to put more measures forward to recognize that gun violence is a public health epidemic, just like Robert said. And I think that we will see, I feel confident from our discussions with the White House, we will see more executive actions, more budget funding, and more steps to ensure that gun violence is tackled as the true public health epidemic it is, including through agencies like Health and Human Services, CDC, and other public health entities.
Robert, I wanted to ask you about some of the language President Biden has already used about gun violence, because a lot of American politicians, especially conservative ones, tend to react to mass shooting events by just using fairly morally neutral words like tragedy, as if these are natural disasters like, you know, hurricanes or fires, and there's nothing you can really do about them. Biden described mass shootings as an embarrassment to the United States. And that's quite strong language to an electorate of proud and patriotic people. Is that something that might cut through?
It is an interesting choice of words on the president's part. And I took note of it just in the way that you did. I don't know that the language by itself is going to result in any measurable change in people's attitudes, but I do think it takes a different tone and a perfectly correct tone. To say that it is an embarrassment for us, and it is a way of invoking American pride in a way. And I think it was a smart way to phrase it, to reframe the issue. But at bottom, I mean, he's still pursuing and wants to pursue a very specific agenda on this subject. And with regards to those who have resisted new gun laws, what one often hears is, as you say, kind of neutral language suggesting that mass shooting was just something that happens like a bolt of lightning or a meteor striking the earth or something, which of course is not the case. It is a human-made event that occurs with firearms. I mean, no one has ever heard of a drive-by knifing, for example. There is something unique about firearms that makes them different from any and every other kind of weapons, which is that they are uniquely lethal.
Chris, in the work you've done with Brady, what have you learned about winning people over on this? And by people in this instance, I don't actually mean the public or the voters. I'm talking about the people whose votes are actually going to matter in terms of passing these laws, which is politicians. Have you come across lines of argument that do actually persuade people that they can vote for these kind of things, that the NRA is maybe not as frightening as they seem to think it is. What actually works? What gets people on board?
Look, I mean, from our perspective around these issues, the entire line of reasoning around the Second Amendment is really a red herring. It is the one that the NRA really relies upon. And it's not always something where you win on logic, because the perception from some politicians who have basically refused to put public safety first is, I will be primaried. And in the United States, that is a risk, right? I will be primaried, someone who is absolutely unrelenting in opposing any gun safety measure, if I'm a Republican, is going to run against me, and that person will win. What helps persuade them is the implosion of the NRA. The NRA filed bankruptcy, ostensibly, if you read the media reports in the US, to try to avoid an attorney general investigation by the state of New York that would have denied them their nonprofit status, and an ongoing dispute with their chief marketer, the one that created the dystopic universe that they use to sell guns. So they're foisted by their own petard, to use a Shakespearean quote, and it's not going well for them. The New York Attorney General has made an appearance in that case and is seeking to dissolve the NRA. Of course, winning at the ballot box helps us too, and we have done that.
We are coming to the end of the show, and it's a grim and vexing subject, but we do like to attempt to close on an optimistic and constructive note as and when we possibly can. So I wanted to ask each of you in turn, briefly, how optimistic you allow yourself to be about making meaningful progress on this in the next few years. Robert, I'll put that to you. Do you allow yourself to anticipate improvement?
I think in the long term, there is some reason for guarded optimism. And I would take just one piece of evidence, which is the post-Parkland response by the high school students at Parkland High School in Florida. This was at the start of 2018, when there was another terrible mass shooting in a high school. And instead of doing what students and others have done in the past, which is to seek privacy after, friends are killed by some mass shooter, they stood in front of cameras and microphones and said, we're sick of this. We don't care about your thoughts and prayers. What we want elected officials to do is to do what they're paid to do, which is to address problems and pass laws. And they launched a concerted campaign, rallying thousands, tens of thousands of young people around the country. And that was a key reason why the 2018 midterm elections was an important one on the gun issue. And I think the newer generation of people are taking up this cause in a significant way. And that, I think, is an important harbinger of what could be coming.
And Chris, although I'm assuming anyway that you don't go to work for an organization like Brady unless you are one of life's indefatigable optimists, do you feel much the same about it?
I do. Look, part of the reason I'm involved in this issue is I lived overseas for many years. I lived in Switzerland with my daughters. I have two kids. And the first thing I was asked whenever I met anyone and they figured out I was American was, what's up with gun violence in your country? And for any of us who've traveled outside of the US and lived overseas, you have a perspective about your own country that is very eye-opening. And I came back dedicated to this cause because, to me, it's connected with so many other issues in American life. It's connected with economic opportunity. It's connected with racial justice. It's connected with a civil society in which everyone can walk down the street and go to the movie theater and go to work without the fear of being shot. That's an America I believe in. And I care a lot about the kind of society that I leave my two girls, 19 and 17. So there's no way I'm giving up on this. And I agree absolutely with Robert. For my kids, this is a primary issue. And I do believe that we will address it in my lifetime.
Chris Brown and Robert Spitzer, thank you both very much for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Christy Evans and Emma Searle and edited by Yolene Goffin. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.